purpose causes problems in people's lives. It is not an easy path to follow.
Purpose causes problems. I think there's a bumper sticker in that of some kind.
Finding what you feel you are here to do and or what you're here to serve has a much kind of longer lasting effect than some of the temporary trappings of fame and wealth.
How often do you think about purpose? Big words, I know, but someone once told me that purpose is when the world's greatest gift meets the world's deepest need. And in fact, that person who said that to me is actually here today with us on the Humble Mind podcast. So Richard Olivier is the founder and the artistic director of Olivier Mythodrama and works internationally in leadership development as a keynote speaker, a workshop leader. He's the associate fellow of the Said Business School in the UK, a prolific author with a new book that he's co-written called Archetypes at Work, Evolving Your Story One Character at a Time. Before moving into purpose and leadership work, he was a leading theatre director for more than 10 years and directed Henry V for the opening of Shakespeare's Globe Theatre in London in the late 90s. And finally, yes, if you are wondering about the surname, yes, he is the son of the iconic British stage and film actor, Sir Laurence Olivier as well. So, Richard, thank you so much for jumping on the Humble Mind podcast and being part of the community today.
Pleasure. Lovely to be here.
Wonderful. So when we spoke originally about kind of some of the elements of the conversation that I wanted to speak to you about, the fact that I know you separately as well, we kind of landed on this idea of purpose. And I know that you have your kind of own story about finding and realizing your own purpose of what you are or you were meant to, you know, do in this world. And I suppose in a way, perhaps it's worth also starting with at the end of the introduction there when I was talking about your father. So maybe you can give us a quick sort of snapshot, you know, as to sort of where his life ended and yours started and where the question and the adventure of finding your own purpose started for yourself.
So for me, there was a big question that kind of arose in the wake of my father's death, which was in 1989. I was a young father at the time. I was a young theatre director. I had imagined for many years that my purpose and passion was in theatre, following not quite my father's footsteps, because he was a great actor and I was a humble director. But I was more off stage. I never quite felt comfortable at that time kind of being centre stage. It took me a while to figure out why. And eventually I kind of ran into a kind of dark night, a time where I felt I'd lost my passion for the theatre. I didn't quite understand why, but it happened to kind of coincide a couple of years after my dad had died. And I went in, did some therapy, did some personal development work, did some men's work at that time. The men's movement was just starting in the UK. And I heard James Hillman, the founder of archetypal psychology, talking about purpose and about the soul's code. He wrote a book that your soul has a kind of purpose for you. Some of us find it, some of us don't. And that it's a journey you kind of follow all your life. And I was really intrigued by that and took this forward in my own musings and reflections. You know, is there something that I was born to do that isn't just following, as it were, in the family line and being in theatre? And it was then probably exacerbated through some of the self-development I was doing, of really sort of looking in detail at the legacy of being the son of a famous man. And, you know, as an early film star, I mean, many of your listeners may honestly not know who he is anymore, but in the 1950s, he was probably one of the most well-known actors in the world. He did a lot of Shakespeare on film. He was nominated for 8 Oscars. It was a big deal. And so inevitably growing up in the shadow of someone who casts such a big light can be a little daunting. And I was growing up around, lots of well-known people as well, because the folks who came to hang out on the weekends, would include people like Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor and wow. Robert Wagner and Natalie Wood, Paul Newman and people when they were in town. And so I was kind of in this world that wasn't really a real world. And what I realized, and this was, many years later when I was doing the personal development work, was that most of my colleagues at that time thought like that being rich or being famous was the goal. And I realized in retrospect that I grew up around a lot of people who were rich, who were famous, and at times were definitely not happy. Mm. And so I realized if being rich and being famous doesn't make you happy, what does? And that's when it kind of coincided with this Soul's Code work that James Hillman was doing around the finding what you feel you are here to do and or what you're here to serve has a much kind of longer lasting effect than some of the temporary trappings of fame and wealth. And so that then became really my passion, was to follow that purpose and find where it led me. And funnily enough, it was kind of through directing Henry V, which was one of my dad's better known part, for the opening of the Globe Theatre with a wonderful actor called Mark Rylance. We opened the Globe. We did the whole show as a kind of ritual men's group, because originally it would have been done with an all-male cast. Of course, we were doing what was called at that time original practices. And I started using the story of Henry V as a myth of leadership, a myth of leadership development. Hmm. And we got to do some workshops. Mark was very open to ideas and creative ideas. So we did a Henry V workshop, me and Mark, with a bunch of public sector leaders in London as part of our rehearsal process. And we got these leaders in a room for 2 days and we took them through the story of Henry V, as far as we understood it at that time. And our assumption was that because it was a 400-year-old story, there would be a substantial amount of the leadership within it that was way out of date. And we were interested in knowing what's out of date and what's modern. Hmm. But much to our surprise, when we talked about all the human dilemmas of leadership that Henry faces, particularly in Act One, where he has to unite a whole group of people around a common cause, which effectively he had to state his individual purpose and then co-create a compelling vision for his people that they would be interested in following. And these folks in 1997, these leaders said actually pretty much everything Henry V or Shakespeare has Henry V doing this 400-year-old play is relevant for modern leaders. And so in that moment, it was like a kind of light bulb went on. And this notion of working with wisdom stories and archetypes to develop people, and at that time, leaders, became my kind of driving purpose and passion.
Wow. And I suppose at that point, it felt like a kind of a calling, but then you still needed, I would imagine, quite a few years to then mature that purpose, right, into what it is that you continue to do today. Where, it's almost like, when you you find out that you're good at something, but you still need to practice in order to get better at it, right? So I suppose there was still a journey that would only begin at that point.
Yes, I mean, the journey in terms of being a workshop leader had actually started a few years before when I was asked to do some of the work that was initiated by the men's movement at that time, and then decided to kind of take it out and do work with men and women and non-binary folks as well. So that became, for me, the juice was in using the stories to unlock wisdom in people, rather than working with one particular gender or with one particular mode in mind. So that was something I've been doing for a while. And it was, for some reason, it was when I found the Shakespeare, and obviously many of Shakespeare's plays are about leaders, that's when the leadership piece clicked for me. So I was already, I would say, a reasonably practiced workshop leader. And I was also very lucky. There was that little bit of luck that came into the equation, which I think many entrepreneurs will recognize. When a business takes off, it's not all your plan. There's what happens that you couldn't have planned. And literally, we were doing a press launch at the Globe Theatre of the Shakespeare for Leaders work. And none of the press showed up, right? But it was the weekend of the Academy Awards. And that Sunday night, Shakespeare in Love won Best Film. Suddenly Shakespeare was in the news. And on Monday morning, the press office phones were ringing off the hook from all over the world. People who got this invitation hadn't thought anything of it, who then suddenly thought they had an article to write about Shakespeare. So suddenly we were sort of in, you know, news and radio and papers around, which again wasn't enough to build a business on, but it was enough that people had kind of heard of it. So it made it the work more accessible and potentially more relevant.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a complete stroke of luck that put some wind in our sails.
Yeah, who knew Shakespeare would be a good leadership coach? I suppose. But it's interesting, just for a moment, reflecting on his body of work, and just kind of thinking about some of the plays that I'm familiar with. You know, thinking of Macbeth and Titus Andronicus and Richard and Henry V. They're all either kind of quite toxic or despotic, or at least maybe at the best of them, they're kind of quite reluctant leaders, perhaps even Hamlet, right? He's sort of thrust into something and he's kind of needing to realize a whole lot of things about himself before he can actually take the throne, or I suppose specifically in Hamlet, you know, there's a point where he sort of realizes that, but then it's kind of too late. You know, he sort of dies as he's realizing those sorts of things about existence and himself and so on. So what do you think Shakespeare, if he was sort of whispering to us 400 or 500 years later, is trying to say about leaders when he seems to be giving us these lead characters who are not always that good at leading? is there something to unlock there?
For sure. I mean, I've been unlocking bits of it for 25 years, so it depends how long you've got. But in the headlines, he was holding up a mirror to nature. That's what he has Hamlet say. The purpose of art is to hold a mirror up to nature. And the way we use the work is to hold a mirror up to the human nature of leadership. So leaders are human. We all have our gifts. We have our flaws. When we get on to talk about the archetypes later on, the gifts and shadows will become clearer, I hope, for your listeners, in terms of how we use them in the mythodrama work. But you can learn as much from people who go wrong as you can from people who go right.
Right.
In the same way as I would personally say, I've learned far more from my mistakes in life than I have from my successes. So the successes are nice, but the mistakes are where the learning happens. Mm. And that's, I think, what enables transformation. Now, you know, some leaders in Shakespeare, I mean, we focus on Henry V because he's generally seen as a more heroic figure.
Right.
we focus on Macbeth in contrast with the young Prince Malcolm. Macbeth is some person who's overambitious, who becomes a tyrant. Mm. And Malcolm is the person who starts running away, who ends up being the savior of
Scotland.
So the two journeys kind of dovetail and mirror each other in opposite directions. Mm. We use Julius Caesar with four flawed leaders who all end up, you know, creating a civil war between them around influence and politics and so on. Tempest, Prospero is deeply flawed, but he's enabling another generation to come into being. So we use that about change. And As You Like It is the one where Rosalind, as the kind of heroine of the play, works her magic to change a system from one that has become very corrupt to one that has a chance of regaining some innocence and freshness to it. So we pick very carefully the plays. So we don't use Titus Andronicus. We don't use Richard III. But Macbeth is the good enough kind of role model of a leader that can go wrong.
Yeah.
If you look at the world today, and particularly around a lot of the nationalist politics that are around, you know, there's a big mirror in Macbeth for what we're going through. And those who are ambitious for their own ends rather than for a greater purpose, which is, you know, why we're...
It's a good distinction to make, I suppose, because, you know, you can be ambitious for something that perhaps brings about an eventual good, or perhaps it's entirely self-serving. And I suppose we're in an age right now where that is just too difficult to distinguish. The lines are far too blurred.
Well, you can often tell. It's interesting when I work with people and when we get them to try and identify some of these differences in leaders that they know or respect. The people who have a sense of service, who talk about things they care about that are beyond them. That's what's inspiring. I mean, the difference between Nelson Mandela and Donald Trump, I mean, it couldn't be more stark of who is in service of a greater good and who is simply serving their ego. And one of the problems, I think, of not having a fully formed sense of purpose is that what you're kind of left with, and the purpose, I would argue, is often nudged by or inspired by the soulful part of us. We might call it a soul. Mm. And that the soul kind of has a sense of what we're here to do. And it kind of nudges us when we get too far off course. So the people who are connected to this are those who will have what's classically called the dark night of the soul. Mm. Tyrants, narcissists do not have dark nights of the soul because they don't doubt themselves. Right. They just believe they are God-given gifts to the world and whatever they want should be done. Mm. And that's very different from saying, how can I serve? What am I serving? Mm. Albert Schweitzer, who was a great anthropologist and working in Africa for many years of his life, looking at what was effective service in communities and societies. And someone asked him near the end of his life what he thought the destiny of mankind would be. And he was wise enough to say, I do not know what your destiny will be, but the one thing I do know is this: only those of you who have sought and found how to serve will be truly happy.
Mm. Wow, beautiful. And
ultimately, many of those ego narcissists are not actually happy. And purpose is what gives you internal validation. It's like, I'm here, I know what I'm here to do. And even if I have no great legacy to leave the world, I'm happy to do it. Mm. And so purpose is really not about the size of your ambition. It's about the knowledge of what it's serving and if it feels like the right thing to serve for you. Mm.
I just want to go back to something for a moment before we move on. But when you were speaking about leaders and, you know, making the comparison between someone like Nelson Mandela and Donald Trump. And I suppose there's a couple of those nowadays that we can look to. And without getting kind of political about the options that are on offer, at least in the modern political system that are around us, it seems that there's just this shortage of sensible modern leadership, not only perhaps in political circles, but just in, you know, perhaps in businesses or in sort of more local settings. Where are all the good leaders, do you think? Is it a question of culture, sign of the times? Is it kind of that old dictum of, you know, good times make soft men and soft men make hard times? Like, how do you make sense of that?
Well, I think the whole leadership paradigm is changing. I mean, the bigger purpose of what me and my company are trying to do is help enable a new story. And a new story requires new leaders. And fundamentally, I think, you know, the old story, you know, industrial growth, using the resources of the planet, you know, profit before people, all of that that we've lived with since the Industrial Revolution and all the positive consequences for some in terms of raised economic circumstances, but the negative consequences that we're all now facing in terms of the environment shows us, I believe, that the old story has run out of room and run out of road, and that it's time to create a new story. But it's such, it's almost like a spell, you know, that so many people in the world have been put under around, you know, growth and profit, that eternal growth is supposed to be the way forward, as opposed to all the indigenous societies who are living in a much more circular economy, very naturally, working with the rhythms of the year, with the rhythms of nature,
right.
Kind of co-inhabiting with the earth in a peaceful way rather than domineering. And so that whole dominant thing, which I think is definitely part of the kind of toxic patriarchy, you know, that we are in charge, which is a complete fallacy. I mean, just, you know, as soon as nature gets hold of us, it can toss us off itself and off the earth, you know, in seconds with great quakes or fires or floods or whatever, and seems to be, you know, getting a little more upset with us. I listened to a podcast a couple of years ago that said, you know, if we were still talking about there being gods around, we would be tempted to say the gods are angry, you know, given what we're doing. Right. And it is that, you know, reading the signs of nature. And again, that notion that if we read the signs, what is my world, what is the world saying, that can help us tune into purpose as well. That quote at the beginning, which I should credit, it's Frederick Buchner, German writer, who said, in some version I've adapted it slightly, but that your calling is where your greatest gift meets the world's deepest need. And at times of great need in the world, it is a kind of wake-up call, you know, for as many people as are willing to hear it, that how can our great gifts serve those deep needs? And what's the overlap? Because there are so many, you know, deep needs out there in the world right now, and there are so many great gifts. And purpose is when you find the sweet spot between the two, or one definition of purpose. There are many ways to find purpose, but that one of looking for a need that I feel inspired to meet is one great way. Yeah.
I suppose the use of storytelling, and this is what your business does, and the kind of the unique kind of framework you have, Mythodrama, is where it kind of really comes in to connect with helping to find or at least reveal that purpose, right? Because it is through stories, since, you know, the earliest hunter-gatherers could kind of form words between each other. It's through stories and storytelling that allows us to kind of make sense of an otherwise difficult and inhospitable world around us, right? We kind of use stories as a mechanism to kind of make sense of nature, make sense of why we're around, which is, I suppose, a definition for purpose, right? And so often it seems that finding your purpose is also related to telling yourself a story about your purpose, right? Would you agree with that? Is that a way to kind of look at how you use storytelling in that way?
Absolutely. I mean, we encourage people who are kind of tracking their purpose to create a narrative, of their life, particularly focusing on the times they felt in tune with themselves, the world, their work, and the times they felt out of tune, because that can become a kind of narrative thread that you follow. You know, and I did that when I was tracking my purpose in the 90s there, inspired by James Hillman initially. That was where I got to looking at all the kind of peak experiences that I'd had in my professional life to date, which were all in professional theatre, which the last one of which was Henry V. And in all those pieces, I recognized that I was working with something that I personally saw as a wisdom story, something that human beings could work from. And in all of those times, I was working with people who were interested in developing themselves as we figured out the best way to tell their story. Mm. So it was about wisdom stories and developing people. Those were the two core pieces for me of purpose, you know, and that stayed fairly consistent for the last 20, 25 years, although the archetypes have come in much more since I had a real wake-up call with them about 7 or 8 years ago, that actually archetypes are a slightly more like laser beam entry to purpose.
So let's explore that, because I think, you know, it's fairly sort of easy to understand the role of stories and storytelling and how that was, you know, a kind of a passport for your own purpose. But when it comes to something like archetypes, that probably, you know, a word that a lot of people haven't heard yet before, how do you define it? And what do you mean by kind of the work that you found around archetypes?
Well, you know, archetypal psychology has been around for about 50 years. My partner in the work, Lawrence Hillman, is actually the son of James Hillman, the founder of archetypal psychology. So we started a little club many years ago called The Sun Also Rises, because we were both kind of overshadowed nice by our dads in different ways. And we put sort of knowledge together. My work of being able to activate desired futures, which is what mythodrama is about. It's about acting in your desired future. And his expertise as an archetypal coach. And the archetypes are underlying patterns of human nature and culture. It's like on the surface, what we show to the world is our personality. Right. And then underneath that, we could talk about our psychology, you know, what happened to me as a child or what my kind of natural passions are. Underneath the psychology, there's a deeper layer that is archetypal, that exists, pre-exists anyone's individual, you know, birth or life, that are patterns that go throughout time and throughout history. And the patterns, different cultures will kind of prioritize different archetypal patterns. Archetypes have many different guises. They used to be known as gods. Gods, goddesses, they were the great mythic figures in all the great mythology of the world. These are archetypal figures. The Romans and Greeks had them. The Romans started connecting these archetypes with gods and planets, so that Mars became both the warrior god and the planet Mars. Venus became the goddess of love as well as the planet Venus. So these archetypes have been with us forever. And I think since the first cave painting, since the first creative expressions of human consciousness, we created typologies and types. Mm. Now the archetypes are very deep. You know, a stereotype is superficial, kind of two-dimensional, whereas an archetype is almost four-dimensional. It exists through time and space. But of course, in every age, and we would argue in every individual, it has its own unique expression. So we never become an archetype. It's like we use an archetypal energy which expresses itself through our body in different ways.
Perhaps before you show us more about how you apply archetypes, I'm curious as to where you think the origin story, if you like, or the teleology, if you of kind of where the archetypes come from, because it's easy to sort of spot them after the fact and go, this is a storyteller or a creator or one of the archetypes based on what they exhibit in their traits. But do you think that it comes from something else, perhaps somewhere deeper in our nature? Feel free to speculate, but maybe it kind of crosses over into the realm of belief, but I'm not sure. But where does that originate from? Is that something in our DNA? Is that something in the kind of the spiritus mundi, or how do you derive
that? I think pretty close. I don't think you can prove anything about archetypes. For me, they're underlying patterns. Yeah, so it's not something that you can put a rubber stamp on, but it's something you feel when you're in the presence of. And that's what it is. It's a felt reality. And we can define them in lots of different ways, but we've found a way to define the archetypes in a set of 10 archetypes that for us encompasses all the energies that you need to work with in your life to be an effective agent for your purpose. And indeed, we would argue that it is your archetypal pattern that will deeply inform your purpose in the world. So understanding your archetypal pattern can help you guide people towards their purpose. And particularly when we work with mentors and with leaders, understanding your archetypal pattern is key part of figuring out your purpose. So the set of archetypes that we use, which again, the research, Lawrence has been working, my partner in the work, for 40 years with archetypes, and he feels this is a complete enough set of 10 archetypes that can be divided into 5 realms. And in the leadership work, we call these leadership realms. Order, which is how we organize things, relationship, how we relate to others, creativity, how we innovate, change, how we manage transitions, and action, how we get things done. So 5 realms, 10 archetypes, so 2 in each. So if we start and just go round in the realm of order, this archetype of the sovereign is the one that is deeply connected to vision and purpose. The sovereign is about the why. It's the part of us that is willing to be visible when we know what we're standing up for. And the sovereign part of us will organize ourselves and our lives around vision. So the why is kind of central to the sovereign. The strategist, another equally important part of us, is more about structure and mastery, more about the roadmap. So the sovereign tends to be slightly more heartfelt and courageous. The strategist, more mindful and logical in its approach to creating order. In relationship, we have the nurturer and the lover, where the nurturer is the kind of parental archetype of care and empathy and development. A lot of people in therapy, a lot of the more caring people in human resources have nurturer as a leading archetype, that often people are kind of guided, their purpose will be in caring professions if they have nurturer as a leading archetype, or they will be someone who offers care within another kind of organization. Whereas the lover creates relationships through desire and beauty. The lover creates equal relationships, sociability, what business terms now is called developing social capital, a very capitalist expression for a beautiful archetype. But there we go. We need some functionality somewhere. So The lover will create great brands. You know, Apple as a brand has a lot of lover energy in it versus, you know, Microsoft when Apple first came out. And the people, that the idea that, you know, that you're worth it, self-worth often has a big part in the lover archetype. Whereas the nurturer might be much more focused on giving to others. And eventually, often you hear the phrase, you know, who cares for the carers, because they can burn out in helping others. The lover will tend to have a better sense of self-worth and what they need. In creativity, we have the dreamer and the storyteller as two complementary but different archetypes, where the dreamer is the part of us that can be inspired by things in our imagination. So inspiration and imagination. A lot of entrepreneurs who will listen to the podcast will probably be familiar with that idea that a notion kind of lodges itself in your head before it's logical, before a product exists. For me, it happened that dreamer's a big part of my archetypal pattern and always has been. The word mythodrama appeared in my journal 4 years before I did the first mythodrama event. But it just occurred, and it was like, that's something. I've got to catch that. I've got to put it down. The dreamer gives us intuitions of the future. Or if we listen to the dreamer part of us, we can sometimes hear the whispers of the future talking to us. So it's not logical. It's not strategic. It is in entering into dreamland, but ultimately with a creative purpose. Whereas the storyteller, again, is often the more logical part of creativity, about communication and synthesis. So communication, where have we been? Where are we now? Where are we going? The kind of narrative thread that can hold people and nations together and give us a sense of where we're going for individual teams, you know, organizations and cultures.
That was my one when I took the assessment yesterday. I'll make sure the assessment link goes into the show notes as well. I'm sure some people would be.
Yeah, we have a little free assessment, 50 questions, where you get your top archetype and your bottom. And usually the top one is spot on. The bottom one can be slightly adaptable depending on circumstances, but the top one is very often your core. I test the explorer as my top, and then in the more detailed analysis we do, the dreamer is almost always my number two. So the storyteller, then the synthesis, the making connections, the building networks, you know, so it's perfect for the humble mind, you know, that everything you do is in service of a network, connecting people, connecting ideas, putting ideas together. Yep. Classic gifts of the storyteller, kind of on purpose and on song. In the realm of change, we have the renegade and the transformer, which both want change, but they do it in a very different pace. So the renegade is connected to invention and disruption. And that disruption can feel very uncomfortable to others around them when the renegade creates things. If you think of a lot of the new IT, what artificial intelligence is doing right now to the world, that's renegade technology. It's kind of creating a revolution. And what's happening now, like to people who make videos, having just heard that there's a video GPT app coming out. I mean, that's renegade disruption. Renegade disruption for sure. But the renegade is another part of us that can see the future, that can just sense that this isn't working anymore. And kind of like, you know, the old Zuckerberg quote, you know, we've got to break things in order to get things moving. So they're not afraid to make people and things uncomfortable. Whereas the transformer, more about mystery and regeneration, the transformer tends to honor the natural rhythms of life and death and rebirth. So they understand that often for meaningful change to happen, things need to be buried and die, as well as need to be birthed and nurtured into new being.
Interesting distinction between the two. Even though they're adjacent, they're kind of quite different in the way that they pursue the same goal.
Absolutely. And the Transformer is kind of more shamanic, more of the kind of magician energy around it that is willing to dig deep to understand the root causes of things, whereas the Renegade tends to just jump into the future and not worry about why things are as they are. Let's just create the future we need and it'll take care of itself. And I definitely argue in organizations that are going through culture change, you need both. If you don't have Renegades, you won't move fast enough. But if you don't have Transformers, you'll definitely break too many things and probably lose too many people along the way. And then last but not least, in the realm of action, we have the warrior and the explorer. So the warrior is the part of us, the martial part of us, that can challenge inappropriate behavior, that can defend our boundaries, that is ambitious to achieve, that the warrior wants a target and it wants to win. And it often has goals. The explorer is more about adventure and truth. So if the warrior has a goal, the explorer is on a quest that often doesn't have a timeline to it. It can be the inner or outer adventure. So outer adventure, climbing mountains, inner adventure, really trying to think about the meaning of life and the philosophy that I believe in. What's my philosophy of life?
Would you say Hamlet was an explorer?
Yes, for sure. That his whole kind of quest for meaning, but it also meant that sometimes he perhaps didn't take action quickly enough, which is where a more activated warrior could have helped him perhaps to avoid a lot of the tragedy that happens in that great story. And the other side of the explorer then is truth. What's true? That social justice, those who are called to work their purpose in social justice, will often have explorer as a leading archetype. That sense of what's fair and what's unfair, and how can I do something about it? So that's then the 10 archetypes around the five realms. And coming back, you know, to the original question about what does that have to do with purpose, we find that if a leader's leading archetype connects them deeply with what they do or what they believe in, they will likely feel that they are on purpose. And if we are on purpose, that brings with it lots of potential opportunities. Now, the archetype that specifically addresses purpose is sovereign, right? So the sovereign is the part of us that will help us find purpose. But that purpose might be found in any of the 10 archetypes. Does that make sense? Is that clear enough?
Yeah, great. I suppose I just want to make sure that everyone follows along. So when you have a particular archetype, for example, mine, you know, was storyteller, that doesn't mean that that's my only archetype, but rather that's kind of my most dominant one. How would you kind of just sort of simplify or make sure that people understand that, you know, that we kind of carry an essence of all of these, and they sort of activate in different moments, but only one of them, or only, you know, a cross section of these is what actually lights us up when it comes to our purpose. Is that accurate?
Yes, we all have all of them within us. Different ones may be activated at different times in our life. They all are a pathway to purpose. So whatever one is feels like what we would call one of your leading actors. So when we work with the 10 with people, we tend to ask people to identify their three leading actors. We say these are the archetypes that are running your show on a good day. And then there are usually two that are more offstage, that are not getting much of a look in. And usually most of us have about five in the middle that are kind of competencies, things we can do, we may have done at some point before in our life, but they're not lighting us up at the moment. In terms of purpose, people can change archetypal patterns in their life. The same way some people's purpose could change. You know, originally I thought my purpose was in theater. Now I feel it's very much in leadership and personal development work. And the archetype that's kind of guiding that can change as well for some people. Some people have what we would call a much more focused archetypal pattern, like this is who I am and this is the way it will always be. And others have a much kind of broader scope. And over this point in my life, actually this part of me is leading. And over this, and when I move out of that city or out of that job, a whole other part of me comes in. And I kind of feel like a different person. That would be a clue that you've shifted archetypes. So there isn't a set way that we always have three or we always have one. It can shift. Most of us have what I would call a kind of core one or two archetypes that we always want with us, that the work we do needs to be using one of our key archetypes in order for us to feel happy and all.
It's interesting when you said about shifting the archetype, because I find sometimes, perhaps it's not the same thing, but I find that sensation of kind of something changing. Like you mentioned, if it's a big life event or you move to another city, or, you know, I find that happens sometimes with different people who might be in front of me. There's a kind of another side of me that's kind of activated, and you kind of adapt your communication or whatever it might be. Perhaps that's just me. I don't know. Maybe that's part of the archetype that I inhabit, but there's, you know, it kind of comes out in different ways. And I suppose the more you notice it, the better, you become at noticing it, I suppose, right?
Yeah. So there's kind of core archetypes, the ones that you feel are closest to you generally most of the time. And then there are contextual archetypes, which is how we get drawn into an archetypal field, right? And things are then drawn out of us that may not have been what we think of as our normal pattern. So the reason that we feel very passionately about archetypes as a tool for personal and professional development is that we can consciously change our pattern to suit the situation if we understand how. So most of us, our archetypal pattern will be based on a mixture of nature, nurture, and need. Okay, so nature is kind of who we are. Like the explorer is always going to be part of me. Nurture, how we were brought up, and the family or culture of origin. So for me, you know, the storyteller, both my parents were actors. So sitting around a dining room table, if you haven't got a story to tell, you don't get a look in. So I kind of learnt to tell stories in order to fit in. The storyteller was drawn out of me by my family. And then need is when something shows up in life or in the world that you just feel either impelled to respond to or something forces you to respond to it. So, for instance, during COVID, nurturer is often one of my lesser used ones. It's often been one that I think of as being more off stage. But with a small company locked down who are used to traveling for work, who are suddenly have to develop a whole online business, we all consciously, but I as one of the leaders, had to really consciously step into my nurturer archetype and make sure I was looking after people in a crisis, not just coming up with lots of bright ideas. So that was a need. So that's how we normally kind of get our set. Nature, the bits of us at the core, nurture, how we were brought up, and need, the current context I'm in.
Interesting.
The bit that the archetypal development can offer us are conscious choice and agility. So the ability to say, this is where I am. This is where I want to go. Now, this is the archetypes that I'm currently activating. But looking at where I want to go, these are the archetypes I need to activate to get there. So that instead of just waiting for the world to do it to me, I make a conscious choice to activate that archetype. So if we understand what activating that archetype looks like, we can then make that choice a reality. And the simple way that, I mean, it's a complicated development process in totality, but the simplest way of putting it is you think of it as an actor who has to rehearse a new character. You can rehearse these archetypes, that there are activities that draw you into the archetypal field, right, that create an environment in which the archetype then comes out of you. So it's not like learning a new language, but we call it an embodied language. If you put the archetype into your body, you know, it will begin to teach you from the inside out. And you can work with imagination, you can work with physicality, you can work with emotions. The archetypes have different ways of feeding us emotionally. And we can work mentally. We can think our way towards an archetype as well. So, I mean, a simple example might be as a young, very creative theatre director starting to work with people who didn't have, shall we say, small egos. I would often find myself overpowered, that as a director, I would try and put an idea forward and the older actors would say, oh, no, I'm going to do it the way I always do it, or this is how we should do it. And I found myself without a warrior at that time, unable to really assert my ideas effectively. And having worked then with archetypes for a while, I decided that I would do karate for 6 months, which I did. Now, I hate fighting. I enjoy being competitive on a hockey field many years ago, but actually physical confrontations have always terrified me, and I've never got into a fight if I could ever avoid it. And so pushing myself out of my comfort zone into a karate dojo for 6 months, once a week, was serious rehearsal of the warrior archetype. And it did mean not that I picked more fights at the end of it, for sure, but that I could go back in a rehearsal room and say, no, actually, we're going to try it this way. So I learned to be assertive through inhabiting the rehearsing the warrior energy.
Wow. I just want to linger on what you said there for a moment, and specifically the word no. I think so many of us have a real problem with saying the word no. I mean, you can say it, but meaning it. And a friend of mine who's also part of the community, actually, he also does a different style of work with teams and leaders. And he has an exercise that he does when he kind of asks people to notice what happens in their body when they say the word no. Especially if it's the no that's required, the hard no, you know, like this is my boundary, asserting the warrior. This is where the defense line is. You cannot cross. And he told me the story about this one woman who literally shook in her body by saying the word no. It was just this kind of disagreement that happened, you know, with what's going on in the mind, or what is trying to be asserted, with what the body is truly either incapable or not being inhabited by the right energy in order to make that line in the sand. So it's so interesting how these things need to be embodied. They need to be absolutely embodied because the body has its own very real physical intelligence.
And also I would say, you know, that they're one of the keys to archetypal development is to be able to change the story, because we would say that underlying that, you know, a lot of people who have nurture as a leading archetype find it very difficult to say no. Other people who don't have access to much warrior find it very hard to say no. The renegade finds it incredibly easy, you know, and so does the warrior. So the pattern will help determine that. But underneath that, there is usually a story that either this is how I am or this is how I should be. And the should be often is more compelling and often not helpful. And what we find when we work with people to kind of bring up underused archetypes is that they almost always have a negative story about them. Sometimes one that goes right back to their family of origin. You know, so some people who are uber strategists, who live life through logic, you know, might have had hippie parents who never held a boundary their entire childhood. And they so reject that kind of dreamer freedom that they insist on order and logic and doing everything step by step and having lots of rule. Mm. You know, so then for them, for that strategist to embrace their dreamer because suddenly their company needs a whole new vision and they've got to step into the creative space is going to be incredibly challenging. So sometimes, you know, we need to work under the surface. You can't just have a brainstorming session to fix it. You have to kind of go under the surface and work with the archetypal pattern that's creating the block.
Yeah, absolutely. Could we talk about men's work for a minute? Because that's another fascinating area, one that I've been exposed to over the last couple of months as well. And I suppose when someone might, to the uninitiated, might, you know, hear about men's work, well, you know, what's that? Is that sort of sitting around in a cult, kind of, you know, drinking beer and thumping their chests? But how would you sort of set the context for what men's work is, why it's relevant, and, you know, how perhaps the use of these kinds of archetypes are also being used to do good work, to do necessary work specifically for men and men who need it?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, to say, you know, that as with women, the field of women's development, men's development is very broad. There are lots of different entry points. Some of them very political, some of them very culturally bound. The one that I worked with and still use as part of my portfolio, but not as much as I used to, is the bit that was very loosely called mythopoetic work. So it was using stories, mythology, and at that time, poetry. And you, as you might spot, there's a big homage to mythopoetic work in mythodrama, because I basically added the theater to the mythopoetic work to find my personal passion and purpose with it. But the mythopoetic men's movement was actually formed as a creative response to women's work. It was started by a poet called Robert Bly in the United States in the late 1980s. And it came out of what was called then the Great Mother Conference. So it was a conference that was started initially by a group of women who were interested in women's development and were looking at, you know, being able to be re-inspired by some of the ancient goddess energy that had obviously been crushed by the patriarchy. Hmm. And then at a certain point, they invited some men they thought could be creative partners to come into the conference, and they opened the conference up so it became available to mixed groups, not just women's groups, or for part of the time. And Robert started working in this, doing fairy stories and like Grimm's tales as tales of development. And at a certain point in one of the conferences, they divided into groups of men and women. And he told the story to a group of men, and Marianne Woodman, great Jungian author, told fairy tales to groups of women. And they processed them separately, and then they came together and shared some of their pieces. And both groups came back and said, well, we, you know, this has all been valuable, but actually sometimes working with a story that within a single gender felt really valuable and important, to have a space where we weren't immediately trying to share with another gender, but we were able to kind of be with folks who identified in the same way as us. And so Robert, a lot of the guys who were there said, can we do more of this? And that's basically, he started doing it. So in one way, I would say that the mythopoetic men's work is an homage to the work that was done by women to redefine themselves in the 60s and 70s. And the initiating question was, you know, women have done a lot of work, and there may still be, you know, more to do, but they've really spent time looking at what is it like to be a woman at this point in human consciousness and history. Shouldn't men do the same? Shouldn't men also have the opportunity and perhaps need the opportunity to go, well, what is it if I get out of my old roles, you know, where I have to be the breadwinner or the stern guy at the table reading a paper or whatever those, you know, old stereotypes of masculinity were that in post-war that kind of came up. What if we question them? What if we look at them in a different way? What if we think about which of them are still useful and can we, you know, initially perhaps necessarily separately, but then of course together with groups of women, you know, create a new story for all of us. So that's where it came from, and I came across it in 1995. This was after my dad had died, and I was sort of on this in this dark night of not knowing who I was, and it really became a way of holding my process creatively that I loved, the working with archetypes, working with stories, hearing poems. I hadn't read a poem since I did my last English exam, you know, at school. And just hearing the wisdom in poets, opening my heart and my mind to different ways of thinking, was amazing. And really made a huge difference. And if it's okay, I can share a little poem with you that I'm thinking of as I talk about this.
Yeah, don't let me stop you.
Rainer Maria Rilke, great German poet. And it was, again, talking about like duty and calling. It says, a man stands up, one day a man stands up during supper and walks outside and keeps walking because of a church that stands somewhere in the east. And his children say blessings on him as if he was dead. And another man stays in the house and dies there, inside the dishes and inside the glasses, so that his children have to go far out into the world towards that same church which he forgot. And that is a very kind of classic dilemma. I would argue it's a dilemma for everyone finding purpose these days. When Rilke wrote it, it was perhaps more for the masculine part of the psyche or for men at that time. But that notion of, do I do what I'm supposed to do or do I do what I'm called to do? You know, and do I do what feels safe or do I do what feels risky? And all of the, you know, and it's a dilemma, you know, and I'm sure most people, I know I've been there. You know, I would say both of my parents were probably workaholics. You know, I was brought up by people paid to look after me a lot of the time when they were both on stage when I was a youngster. So I've felt the pain of someone who went to their church and left the family. And I've also been that person who found a purpose and was then, you know, traveling abroad to do important leadership work during the week and getting invited to the World Economic Forum and feeling quite important for a while. And knowing that my kids were then left at home. So that thing of like duty and soul of and how to marry the two most effectively. I mean, I think I've found, I mean, they're older now, but I've found a much more effective way of doing it now, of finding the balance. But initially, coming back to our sort of original notion of purpose, purpose causes problems in people's lives. It is not an easy path to follow because it will call us away from those we love. It will call us away from family or people of origin. You know, it will cause dilemmas. And, you know, the other side of it, if we don't, we might end up feeling we're dying there, you know, in the small town we grew up in without ever having explored the world, having never taken a risk. So these are the kind of things, you know, that would be explored in some of the early men's work that I was involved in. Yeah. I, you know, encourage, you know, all the men and the women listening to do work that may be single gender if you feel called to it for a certain point, because it will inform you in a different way and get to ask questions and potentially be more real and feel more authentic in some of those circles than you can with your friends in the coffee shop or the pub or the yes. dance where you might meet. Yeah.
I'm just reflecting on what you just said. I've never heard those words in a sentence quite like that before. Purpose causes problems. I think there's a bumper sticker in that of some kind. But I suppose it obviously resonates in some way, and goes back to that poem by Rilke, right? It's that, do I stay or do I go? Do I go out into the world and stick a flag in the ground, or do I get lost in packing the dishwasher? You know, and I love that line, the dishes and the glasses. It's so sort of kind of arbitrary and kind of suburban and meaningless, isn't it? It's kind of just like, you know, lost in the dishes. At the same time, I suppose it causes problems, because what might be my purpose, and especially when you bring family and other core kind of instinctual biological things that we do in life, when you have kids, when you, you know, take on a partner, when you do these things, it's not always going to be other people's purpose. In fact, it's almost never, you know, your purpose is different to somebody else's. And so to manage a household and to have kids becomes a real management exercise that perhaps a lot of people don't quite appreciate. What I want to just explore, maybe as one of the last things we talk about, is something back into the beginning. You mentioned the word purpose codes, or the phrase purpose codes. I'm interested to understand why you use the word codes, because that's, yeah, there's something interesting about that. It almost sounds like there's a sort of a program at work, and perhaps that's, so no, I don't mean that in a to dismiss it. Perhaps that's kind of related to the archetypes, where there is a sort of a structure to each of those identities, and maybe similarly, there's a code to each of the purposes that we ultimately take or seek for ourselves. Just interested in your thinking on that.
Well, the book I was referring to was one of James Hillman's best books, called The Soul's Code, In Search of Character and Calling, which again, I recommend to folks who are really interested in following up on purpose and calling. The theory is, and it's based on Platonic thinking and some stuff that was around the Renaissance, Neoplatonic thought, and then archetypal psychology, obviously. And the thinking behind it is that our soul knows what we're here to do. And sometimes our personality or our family get in the way. And that your job, therefore, is to figure out what that code is in order to live a truly fulfilling life. And that's what purpose does. The gift of purpose is that we feel fulfilled, that we feel that I'm doing what I'm here to do. Now, what's really important, it doesn't have to be a huge project in the world. Some people are truly called, and their purpose is bringing up children, looking after local kids, running a local corner shop and being a resource for the community, running a local garden and tending plants. There's no right size to purpose, but finding what that purpose is takes a while. And the archetypes are different pathways. You know, if you know, and you know, you've got lots going on in your life, so you don't need to do this, Alex, but you know, if you did get to a point, it would be, okay, so if storyteller is a key part of what brings me purpose and happiness in life, and the old ways of doing the storyteller aren't, you know, inspiring me at this point, what other ways could I explore? What are the other ways of being a storyteller? So you can, once you know your pattern, you can kind of get an idea of the kind of career paths, the kind of opportunities, even the kind of projects and hobbies that would be most likely to get you up in the morning with a smile on your face. because that's what being aligned with purpose tends to do. It means that I see the world as a place of opportunity, even in the face of great challenge, witness Nelson Mandela again, rather than that the world is a problem that I have to solve.
That's a really great distinction. And just a great way of thinking about purpose as something that sort of once you've kind of got the right glasses on, it kind of emerges rather than something that you have to kind of force out or sort of put a whole lot of work into. Because I think a lot of people do that, right? We've got this craze in modern society about productivity and optimizing things and kind of getting better and squeezing out every last little ounce of efficiency out of everything, which is all about doing more work, more. But I suppose there's something to be said about sort of just letting it kind of tap you on the shoulder gently when you're in a calmer or quieter moment. I know you didn't say that, but it kind of feels like that could be a way to characterize it, where purpose is something that kind of speaks through you rather than something that you have to kind of actively go and sort of, kind of knock out with a giant instrument.
No, very good. I would say you're certainly not knockout, but there's probably a dance between kind of action and receptivity for most of us. You know, some people just get a calling. You know, some people just wake up one morning and they know what they're here to do. Most of us, it takes quite a bit of time on life's path to go on a few wrong tracks and not even realize the right track when we're on it often until we've come off it.
Right.
The times when we were in tune, when we were in flow, are clues. So if we can activate the kind of quest for purpose by doing some journaling, by doing some imagining, by remembering the times when we felt on song, you know, you can build a kind of portfolio of times you've been alive, the people that bring you alive, the activities that bring you alive, the work that's brought you most alive. You can kind of build all of that. And then there's a time to be receptive, to do the meditation, to go for long walks, to get a watercolor set out and see what emerges, to be creative. And then there's usually a time for coaching, you know, where it's helpful to find someone who can help nudge you or help you craft a purpose. So sometimes, you know, if we're working with people on a 3 to 5 day workshop, you know, we will get them to spend half a day doing that process, work in progress, purpose statement for themselves that they're not wedded to, but it just gives them a kind of line in the sand that they can take away and amend or change or adopt or throw away later, but making some kind of effort, but as you say, not too rigorous. You're not a detective searching in every corner and throwing out, you know, searching every part of life. That's too active, but that some balance of allowing space and inviting the soul to come in and give you a nudge.
Yeah, great distinction. I'm conscious that while we've been speaking a little bit about men's work, there happens to be a woman on our call as well. So Rana, I'd love to invite you, if you've got any thoughts or anything that's come to you during the course of this wonderful conversation with Richard.
So I think the question is not if there have been any comments, responses. There have been many things, Richard, thank you so much. And as well, Alex, that have resonated with me through all of the conversation, and including that of the men's work. I do have a specific question, and this goes back towards the beginning and has been referenced. And you spoke about the work that we do with leadership, and talking about, Alex, you mentioned the kind of lack of the dearth of leaders that come from this place of serving something else besides a personal ambition. And just that word leadership, and how we talk about being associated with leaders and being a leadership coach, there's a sense of not necessarily elitism, but this elevated sense of a role. And I'm wanting to know if you could speak to how can we frame it? How can each of us, regardless of how large the radius is of our purpose, how can we hold those spaces, places, and characteristics of leadership as we embrace our archetypes, as we discover those archetypes? How can we take that role of leadership into ourselves, regardless of what our purposes look like?
Thank you. I mean, if I may, first of all, kind of big picture stuff. On an archetypal level, the age of Aquarius that we're moving into is the age of the renegade. And we are coming out of an age that was defined by hierarchy as well as patriarchy. And the hierarchy is a pyramid with one person on the top. And to the detriment of many millions of people, it's often a white guy on the top, right? So that's what we're coming out of. The Aquarian paradigm of leadership is a network where I'm a node in a network, you're a node, Alex is a node, and we work together, but we all have leadership. So that it's, if you like, we would call it a society of sovereigns, would be one of the ways that Lawrence Hillman would describe the new age of what we're moving towards, where we all have sovereignty. It's not one person who has authority over others, but we might have sovereignty in different directions. So one might have sovereignty as a leadership coach, one might have sovereignty as being an entrepreneur, one might have sovereignty as running a family and connecting with local community. All those sovereignties in the best possible evocation of the new age would be equal and equally valued.
Just to add to that, to what Alex's comment about this absence or dearth of leaders in the spotlight, would that kind of, I feel like what you're sharing and how you're framing that is actually kind of speaks to that as to why there isn't these people that are striving to be at the top of that pyramid, because being at the top of that pyramid in some sense in that old framework is indicative of a sense of domination, of being on top. Mm-hmm. And that a true leader is not about, at least in my perspective, it's not about being that dominant or having authority over. It's creating and fostering that sense of sustainability and collaboration. And so that's, you know, as somebody who is a citizen of the US, who is in Thessaloniki for very reason because of what is going on in my country, amongst other things. But, you know, right now the US is a prime example of what that power, what that authority, how it can be perverse into something that is so destructive. And so that's why we don't have those leaders striving to that point or that peak.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think, you know, that the legacy of being at the top of the pyramid for those who feel connected to soul, who want to live on purpose, who believe in equality in some way, shape, or form, it just feels toxic. You know, it feels like literally I would sell my soul if I went for that top job. So there's the danger, however, and this is why I believe passionately in leadership development with all levels and across all sectors, is that if we don't encourage people with soul to stay in the game and get to the top, we are going to be in the hands of self-serving leaders, without a doubt. Because the people who are in it for the profit, in it for the ego, in it for the kudos, don't care what they do when they get to the top. And I think there's another, you know, cultural problem, well, particularly for the youth of today, for Gen Z and what comes after, is that when they look at the pyramids, they're saying, but this is the stuff that's caused all the shit. Mm. Why the hell would I want to join that? If I'm going to do anything, I'm going to become an entrepreneur. I'm going to have my own startup. I'm going to work with my mates, because then we can do it our way. And if I go into that old pyramid system, I have to become, you know, a suit. I have to lose my integrity or my individuality and sell out, you know, to the corporate way of doing things. So for me, it's a real dilemma, because we know that many corporate structures have caused a huge amount of damage. And if we don't fix them from the inside, we're going to have to wait till there's a bloody revolution to sort it from the outside, which personally I would rather avoid. And there are, I've got some friends who think that's the only way it will happen, and that it has to all collapse in possibly a very chaotic way. But perhaps with my optimistic explorer hat on, I think if we can have the activists working from the outside and the social entrepreneurs creating new ways of doing business, and we can have the patience and the integrity to work with leaders in systems so they can bring more heart and soul to the old failing systems, that's our best chance of a sustainable future.
Absolutely. I think this is, you've pretty much just characterized the entire Gen Z. I think that's pretty much exactly how they feel. I'm a millennial, so I'm the generation beyond that. And I think that a lot of millennials, a lot of us feel exactly the same way, right? Why would I want to kind of dedicate everything that I, all of the potential that I have, all of the capability that I have to what is clearly rotting completely? Perhaps every generation has that kind of watershed moment, though, you know, where they see, well, shit, I'm not going to be like that. I'm going to run away as far as I can. That's not to take away from what you were saying, but I think that there's perhaps a sort of a bigger pattern at play here that is also working its way, wending its way forward as well, right? Where there's a response and a call and response going on, that's perhaps just how humankind works as well. But definitely, I think we can all agree that the core element of what's missing in modern leadership is definitely the space for service, the space to serve, rather than the crimping all of the space to rather just dominate and take everything. Just lastly, before we let you go, Richard, what are you up to right now, aside from enjoying the sunny winter in Spain like I am? I know that you've got a new book out, Archetypes at Work. Is there anything else worth kind of mentioning or knowing about what's got your attention at the moment?
On a personal level, I'm creating a little mini retreat center up in Lecrin in Andalusia. So I'm working on business plans for that. We will open next year, 2025, and part of the title is called ARC Shalita, and ARC stands for the Archetype Resource Center. So we're going to be inviting people to come and play with their archetypes or work on their new archetypal patterns or what their business might need from them at this time up there, as well as do some more lab work, experimental work, looking at how are the archetypes evolving in our time, you know, in this new Aquarian age, what are the archetypes wanting to bring through? Because there is a sense that the archetypal patterns, there's part of them that stays the same, there's part of them that shifts from age to age. So I'm very curious about how they're shifting, and can we listen to the whispers of the future archetypes talking to us now, so we can kind of accelerate this journey to a new story. So that's the kind of practical bit going into the more philosophical bit. And then me and Lawrence are designing new methods of working with the archetypes. So we're working a new team offer to work with teams. So you can look at the pattern of a team, not just of an individual, and see what's going to help them be future fit. And we've got an archetypal preference report, which is a very a 25-page report where people get all of their 10 archetypes scored, which has been out for a couple of years and been going really well. And we're now developing an archetype feedback report. So you can kind of tell us who you think you are, and then your team can also give you feedback to create what we hope is a feedback culture, because the archetypes have shadows as well as gifts, and often leaders don't recognize when they're stepping into the shadows of their leadership gifts, when they're doing too much of a good thing, and those around them will almost always see it first. So getting that 360 input, we hope, will be a really valuable offer for leaders and teams in the future.
Wonderful. Well, I can only hope that you'll be back again with us to share some more about what you're learning and what you're thinking about. It was a real honor to chat with you and to just think about a whole lot of really important concepts together. I know that the community will really enjoy it. So thank you again for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. And thank you, Rana, for joining us. What a pleasure to have you here as well. So, and thanks for all your wonderful questions, Alex. And blessings on the network. I look forward to being part of it in the future.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of Humble Mind. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're curious to take a look at our community, if you're not a member, you're missing out. Make sure you head to humblemind.co to check out more and to see what we're up to. I look forward to seeing you there. Until next time.